grieving. Some families will be lost to one another forever. To those of you who face the difficulties of reconnecting with family and establishing ongoing relationships, we say sorry. We offer this apology in the hope that it will assist your healing and in order to shine a light on a dark period of our nation's history. To those who have fought for the truth to be heard, we hear you now.
You're listening to Adopt Perspective, a podcast for anyone affected by adoption. I'm one of your hosts, Jo Sparrow. This podcast is a production of Jigsaw Queensland Post-Adoption Support Service. However, the views expressed are those of the people participating, not necessarily Jigsaw Queensland. The podcast discusses adult themes and listener discretion is advised. Welcome to Adopt Perspective. I'm your host, Jo Sparrow. Brendan Watkins was 8 years old when his parents told him that he was adopted. When he was in his late 20s, he started searching for his biological parents and eventually discovered the identity of his mother. He was later told that following his birth, she'd become a Catholic nun and that she wanted nothing to do with him. For the next 30 years, Brendan had no clues as to the identity of his father. In 2018, a DNA test provided the answer. He was the son of a priest. His father had studied in a Trappist monastery in Ireland and had returned to Australia and become a celebrated outback missionary. After decades of searching and obstruction from the Catholic Church, the whole truth was finally exposed. Brendan Watkins' biological parents were a Catholic priest and later a nun. Brendan wrote a memoir about his experience called Tell No One that not only explores his own experience, but also the wider issue of cover-ups by the Catholic Church. He's joining us today to share his story and also some of his writing process and where things have settled after its release. Welcome to Adopt Perspective, Brendan. I'm thrilled to have you join us.
Hi, Jo. How are you going?
Good, thank you. And you just told me you're very relaxed because you've just been on a break.
Yeah, we've just got back from a few days down at the beach. So, I'm feeling pretty chill.
Nice. I'm going to try and absorb some of that chill, I think, because I haven't had a holiday anywhere near recent enough.
We haven't had too many either. So feeling relaxed.
Wonderful. Look, Brendan, firstly, congratulations on writing an outstanding book. I could not put it down. And I know everyone back in the Jigsaw offices was the same when they first read it as well. And I've been wanting to interview you ever since, well, actually before its publication in August 2023, but I left it a little while to reach out to you so that I could talk to you about not only the book, but how the dust has settled since you put it out there. So can I start by asking you just how has the book been received?
I think really well. Sales have been solid, I'm told. I've had an enormous number of people approach me, either through social media or through the agent or publisher or various other means, that have been either adopted or people that have found relatives through DNA, be it ancestry or whatever, or probably the majority of those in that subset of people who have been negatively impacted by the Catholic Church. And so, yeah, there's certainly been a number of children of priests, but all sorts of people with all sorts of stories about the church that, have had similar sorts of experiences to me, where their origin documents have gone missing and they've been told lies by the church, and largely people that have been treated by the church in the most unchristian of ways.
Yeah. Brendan, you weren't told that you were adopted until you were about 8 years old, which I was told when I was born. So 8 is actually a fairly long time to wait to be told. I wonder if you could tell us a little about your childhood and how you were impacted by that news.
My childhood, my upbringing was fabulous. So I was really fortunate. I had wonderful parents that gave unconditional love right through until their deaths around, you know, the early 2000s. I have a brother, so he's a little older. He's also adopted. And we were sat down, I think, after Mass is my recollection, on a Sunday when I was about eight, and told that we were adopted. And for me, it was one of the most monumental days I can ever recall. And, you know, I believe I can recall, you know, everything about the moment, you know, the posters on the wall, the smell that was coming from the kitchen, the roast that was in the oven, what my parents were wearing. My brother, conversely, has no recollection. He thought we always knew. And, we, you know, from that moment on, we've gone forward where, you know, my brother's not particularly interested about finding out any of his, you know, origin ancestry stories. And I've always been obsessed. For me, finding out that I was adopted somehow or other explained some of the things that I think were in my head as a kid. You know, it's hard to, you know, really recollect these things accurately, but that's my thought about when we were told. It was really significant. But we had a really fabulous upbringing. And it didn't change anything, but it certainly was the beginning of the spike of my interest wanting to know more, and certainly to observe closely our family. And our family couldn't be more different. And I know lots of siblings and parents are different from their kids, and there's lots of variation. But to me, our family just couldn't be more different. Looks, preferences, likes, you know, be it food or music or sport or film, we were just so different. And I was always keenly aware of that and observed it very closely, and still do.
Yeah, sounds a lot like my own experience. I think while I was always told I was five when that penny really dropped and I understood what adoption meant. And from that moment on, it just became my obsession to want to know where I came from and noticing all of the differences. So it sounds like we had a bit of a similar experience in that way.
Yeah.
Your parents were devout Catholics and you regularly attended church services and were schooled in the Catholic school system. What was that experience like for you?
I guess being a kid growing through that system, it's only later that you realise the severity of the indoctrination. It's only when you can compare the experience to others. I was a big reader, so I think I read a lot and was reading about other, you know, sorts of upbringings that people had. And it was only years later, really, that you look at, you know, more secular scenarios or education systems and saw how hard line ours was. So I was born in 61. So, you know, we're talking the 60s and the 70s. And certainly the religious indoctrination was fierce. And at times, the bastardry at the school was, well, it was horrific. You know, I tell my kids stories about some of the things that went on, and they're just agog at how extreme some of the things were. And certainly, you know, one of my close mates was bashed by a brother, beaten mercilessly. And there was all sorts of things that went on within the school, within the institution, through the church, that we were very, very much trained around not talking about these things and being silent and, you know, praying and discussion and being open about things was never strongly encouraged. And certainly being adopted and being in a system that in some ways was, you know, a bit like survival of the fittest, you didn't want to have your, you know, the chink in your armor exposed. And there were some other kids at the school that were adopted, and a couple in particular that really had problems, and everyone knew they were adopted. And one of them poured Moishe on himself and lit it.
Okay.
And he was adopted. So I certainly didn't want to be identified as one of those. And the other message about adoptees, or given to adoptees in a fairly subtle way, was that you should be grateful. And it was all about showing gratitude. And that was part of the Christian ethos. But showing gratitude meant not asking questions about the adoption. And there was this communication of the notion that you were communicating to your adoptive parents that you weren't grateful for what they were giving you if you asked questions. And so people buried things, they internalized it. And I think for a lot of kids that struggled with it, it demonstrated. That struggle demonstrated itself in all sorts of antisocial ways further down the track, and there's lots of stats around that confirm that.
Nothing much good grows in the dark, does it?
No.
What eventually led you to searching for your biological parents?
Well, I always wanted to know. I was always super curious, and I suppose, this grateful notion was always in my head about not wanting to appear ungrateful, and certainly not wanting to upset my devout parents. And in a lot of ways, I suppose in hindsight, I was looking for an excuse to justify taking the next step. And initially, I had no option to find out more about who I was. It was in Victoria, the laws changed in the 1980s. I think 84 was when adoptees were given access to original birth documents. And the thing that got me over the line was we were about to have kids. And my partner, Kate, found out she had this medical condition that meant she was allergic to anesthetics, malignant hypothermia. And it was a big thing. Didn't affect her life day to day, but it certainly took the life of ancestors of hers who went in for routine medical procedures and died on the operating table. One relative had a nose cauterized and had this response, and it brought front of mind to me that it was quite possible, if we were going to go down the track of having kids, and that's certainly what we were discussing, that they could have this. It was likely they were to have this. And it was possible that I had that. And the questions of, well, what else do I have? What are my medical predispositions? And the sort of justification of still being grateful, and wanting to know this medical biological information is what got me over the line. And so, when I was in my 27, 28-year-old age, and thinking about kids, I applied for my original birth certificate.
Yeah. So tell us about your experience with the Catholic Family Welfare Bureau when you just went to get that some more information.
Well, it was, look, I spent a lot of time writing about that and rewriting and rewriting. It was such a cold and foreboding response. And I won't labour it too much, but look, the church representatives were very discouraging of going down the path that I wanted to go down. The state government had provided the authority to all of the individual adoption agencies to manage the process in the way they saw fit, with certain guidelines, so mainly all the church adoption agencies, and they were very foreboding. And I didn't get a good reception when I was quite adamant that what I wanted was contact with my mother. My father's name wasn't on the birth certificate, and the church insisted that they would Well, no, they didn't insist. The church was very, very keen for them to make contact on my behalf, of my birth mother. And I reluctantly agreed, and I was shooed away and told, if they found her, if she was alive, that they would let me know in due course. And eventually they did. They called me back a couple of weeks later, and my mother wasn't a nun when I was conceived or born. She had been a woman that had entered a convent, but she left, and some years later, it was 2 or 3 years later, she had me. And then fairly quickly after I was born and given up for adoption, she entered another convent and stayed there for 25 years. And she says she did that to pay her penance. It was an act of atonement. And the irony was, I'm sorry if I'm jumping ahead here, but the irony was that, 25 years later, after not long after she'd left the convent and resigned, I'd got my birth certificate and made contact, which is the last thing she was expecting, or as it turned out, wanting.
Yeah. So your mother's name was Maggie. How did she reply when she was contacted? What did you hear back?
Well, essentially, I was sat down and told in a very blunt fashion that there would be no contact. She is alive. She's in another state. There'll be no communication. There'll be no meeting. And I need to go home and forget about Maggie forever.
But you didn't go home and forget about meeting Maggie forever, did you? What happened next?
Well, it took weeks. Well, it actually took months, but I had a really legitimate reason to want to get this in the least biological medical information. I'd explained to the Catholic Family Welfare Bureau the reasons of wanting this information about the cult's issue, and she apparently had passed that on to Maggie, and still there was going to be nothing. And for the first time, it was not only my issue and my right. This is something that was going to affect Kate, and it was going to impact my kids. And I was really angered by it. I thought, what, you don't have that right. In the very least, at least I should be told the medical information. And so I had a name. I knew where she was born. She was 27. That was unusual when I was born for the woman to be 27. The stereotypical scenario was, a teenager, or a, 16, 17, 18, 20-year-old. And she was 27, another state, and an unusual name. And so even though the internet hadn't been invented, in the early 1990s, it was possible to get on a tram, as I did, and go into the city and pull out a phone book. And I found that she was the only one in the phone book in New South Wales. And then, of course, I sat home, went home and sweated about it for, days on end, and eventually decided to do research around the name, because she was in New South Wales but was from another state, and so was able to get some information through births, deaths, and marriages. And to cut a long story short, Kate made a phone call to a sister-in-law who was in South Australia, just trying to gather some facts about this woman, given not that long earlier we'd made contact through the Catholic Family Welfare Bureau and told, essentially go away, forget about her forever. I didn't want to then go immediately back and write or ring. So we spoke to a sister-in-law, and her response was, "Oh, you mean, when Kate was looking for her long-lost friend, you mean Maggie the nun."
Yeah.
And
Mic drop.
for years after, I was certain, and the mental picture I had of my mother was this None. Wandering around convents, doing good deeds. And of course, as I alluded to earlier, she had actually resigned not long after that contact had been made, but she'd done her 25 years penance. And I just sat back and wondered for some length of time about what the next step should be. And of course, we were in the throes of going ahead. We were late 20s, early 30s, and we're doing a fair bit of travel, and then we had the kids, and I, tried to do the right thing and put it to one side. But of course, particularly when you have kids, it's almost impossible, or I found it absolutely impossible, to put to one side the ancestry and who they're like, and of course still these medical issues.
So you reached out a few times and were sort of largely ignored or rebuffed. But then your wife, sorry, your partner Kate, was your champion and intermediary during these contacts. Why do you think she ended up being successful when your outreaches weren't?
Well, she's not as scary as me.
Also, not as close to it as you.
Look, as it became evident only decades later, she rightly had reasons to be concerned about men. There were very, very few men in her life. And Kate is persuasive and open, and she's the mother of Maggie's grandchildren, her only grandchildren. And the initial approaches were really just around, we just want, we mean you no harm, and there's no anger from myself or her. We're just wanting, because we have children, to know more about the ancestry and certainly the medical issues, and a bridge was eventually built, and very reluctant communication came forward. There were some letters, over years, and eventually a phone call with Kate and her, and then the following week with me. And some years after that, we on a trip north to Queensland, we met her. So yeah, Kate's always had a difficult role in this story, because she certainly feels a lot of loyalty towards Maggie, when often in the early years I was grumpy about the whole thing. Why isn't she playing ball? And Kate could see it from another perspective. And we got lots of different stories about who my father was. He was alive, he was dead, he was married, he had other kids. As soon as she told him she was pregnant, he wanted nothing to do with her. And eventually she told me a name, Paul Hayes, a man in Sydney, which I ended up spending a fair bit of money on a private detective to try and hunt this guy down, and eventually was told it's not true, the name's invented. The private detective had spoken to every Paul Hayes just about in Australia that could potentially have been, around Sydney and that sort of age, comparative age to her. And so eventually I sort of gave up, because it was obvious there was this great secret, and that there was no way she was going to tell me the truth, and she was protecting herself. And I guess part of that is I feared, the worst, as I think a lot of contacting adoptees do, and that she was protecting me. And in a lot of ways, that proved to be the truth.
You did eventually find out the name of your father. How did that happen?
Well, look, it was calling. I've had an absolutely wonderful life. I've had a fantastic upbringing with my adoptive parents, and Kate and I met when, we were sort of early 20s, and we've been together. This weekend we've celebrated our 40 years of being together, and have a couple of wonderful kids and a great extended family and friends. But this had always been a stone in my shoe, and I'd given up on pursuing Maggie because all it caused me was angst. And so that's around 2010. And at a little bit after that period, DNA stories and commercially available DNA home kits became the thing, and there was media coverage of people. But I think initially it was people that were, having DNA tests in the States, and they were being let out of jail because, they're on death row and done a DNA test, and it was conclusive that they couldn't have committed the murder, and they were being released. And then people could get DNA kits and do it from home. And there was lots of stories about adoption and people finding, being curious, not looking like a family. Someone's done their DNA, and guess what? Mum and dad aren't mum and dad, and people finding siblings. And generally in the media, there were lots of happy stories. About these, people reuniting or uniting with family for the first time. And I was thinking, well, that has to be the answer to my paternal story. And resisted and resisted and resisted until in 2015, curiosity got the better of me. And I did my DNA. And, I did it. I sent it off to Ancestry and just, sat down and waited for, the answers to arrive. And unfortunately, it didn't, because my paternal answer was very complicated, and it was something that Kate worked on. I'd felt that I'd had pretty much 30 years of lies, different stories, wrong stories, a wrong name, and there was no way the DNA was immediately going to find my father. And Kate quietly squirreled away and became a, amateur sleuth genealogist, and narrowed down over a few years the man who would prove to be my father. And it was one of four men who were in Sydney. My mother was had been in Sydney. She since moved to Queensland, but it was one of four, and the first person we discounted was a man who was 30 years older than my birth mother, and he was a Catholic priest. So we pared it down to three, and had made a vow to Maggie that we would keep her identity secret because of the shame. And it made it very difficult to make contact with people who were absolutely my family, the Scheel family in New South Wales, without disclosing the identity of my mother. So, you ring cold and say, "Hi, I'm one of you, and I'm not going to tell you who my mother is. Can you tell me who my father is? I want to talk about these three men." And again, it's a long story, but the short version is it was evident the only way of identifying my father was to go back to my birth mother and say, "Look, this is where we're at. Brendan's on his DNA. This is Kate doing this. It's one of these four men." And she told us the truth. My father was a Catholic priest, a man that was 30 years older, Father Vincent Scheel, and he'd spent most of his life as a priest in the outback of South Australia. And they had met when he was working in South Australia, and met her when she was just a, teenager of 14, 15. And they'd remained close right through to his death. In 1992 in Sydney, and in fact they were living under the same roof. After she resigned as being a nun, they moved in together and had a relationship of sorts, even though the more I dug and the more I found out, it was in the very least spiritual abuse. And there was, you know, I learned a lot about the stereotypes of children of priests, and I'm probably jumping ahead again, but it was a very complicated relationship. And even, you know, relationship is the wrong word.
Yeah. Well, there's so much in there, and I don't want to give too much away, because I'm hoping a lot of people pick up the book and read it, because we're not going to be able to do justice to it in this small conversation today. And it's so beautifully written that I think it's a much better way to explore your story. But can I just say how envious I am that you had a Kate to do all of your ancestry DNA stuff, because I find it like accounting or math. I hate it. I don't understand it. And I often wonder whether adopted people actually have an anxiety that comes with doing that exploration also, that suddenly makes it even more confusing, because I really start to get rattled when I go into my DNA and, you know, my highest match is like 340 centimorgans, you know, like a second cousin or first cousin. So it's not an easy route to go down. So yay, Kate.
Yeah, look, she was amazing. There's no way any of this would have happened without her. You know, she had made contact and had this supportive relationship with Maggie, you know, for 30 years. And there's no way I could have done the DNA. She's incredibly persistent and meticulous. But yeah, I think what you said, you know, there's a certain anxiety, I think, for adoptees to nut out those ancestors through agencies like Ancestry. But, you know, I found myself getting really angry with it, because, you know, I was thinking, this is so unfair. You know, why do I have to do this? You know, why has the whole thing been made so difficult? Why has the church that purports itself to be, you know, all caring and loving and helping, be absolutely of no use? And why do I have to do this? Why do I have to spend, you know, it was 3 years.
Yeah.
Until we identified my father. And, you know, I felt it was so wrong that we had to conceal Maggie's identity.
Yeah.
And it makes you feel like an object of shame.
Yeah. It makes you feel complicit. There was a lie that sort of is in my family tree about my existence. And when it's told around me or told to people in front of me, it makes me feel complicit in it. And that really winds me up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even, you know, even having written it and making it public, you know, by far the overwhelming sense is, thank God that's out in the open.
Mm.
But, you know, there is a flip side to it. There is, you know, there is a downside, and there's people that are hurt by it. So there's no silver bullet, but certainly I think my self-justification is, you really have to do what's best for your own emotional and mental health. And when I found out the things I found out, there's no way I could have lived without making public what I discovered.
So one of the things that we as adopted people must often confront when searching and reuniting is processing the sometimes challenging or tragic discoveries that we make about our families or the circumstances of our conception and birth. And that processing often has no end. And just when we think we've made peace with it, something can bring it back to the fore again. The fact that you've published a successful book that has garnered a lot of media attention, which is something you desire as an author, I imagine could also be a double-edged sword, as it keeps you having to talk about your experience and, you know, air quotes, the scandalous nature of the story might attract journalists who view it quite superficially. How has navigating that media attention been for you?
Look, initially, the book came out on the 8th of August last year, and In preparation for that, we'd done a lot of work shooting for ABC's Compass TV show. And, we traveled around South Australia and did a whole lot of shooting. There was a whole lot of initial media pre-launch or communication with media that would coincide with the publication of the book. And in a couple of weeks in the lead up to publication, I had pretty much every day a fairly major interview lined up for 2 or 3 weeks. And look, my feet didn't touch the ground for probably 2 months. And my head was in the space of, I've got to tell the story and I want to sell books, because I was so passionate about making the things that I wanted to be public. And the things I really wanted to be public wasn't necessarily my story, or it wasn't my story. It was about what I'd discovered about the children of priests. And in that first few months, there was so much attention, and I was very, very keen to get out there and talk as much as I possibly could. And I did the Canberra Literary Festival and a whole bunch of things, and it was all great. And the attention kept coming. I was swamped with people that had similar stories, that desperately wanted to talk to me or communicate in one way or another about their story and its similarities to mine. And that sort of dissipated leading up to, I guess leading up to Christmas. And I've done a few podcasts since then, and still there's communication going on with a few people that have made contact, and another Children of Priest organisation. And I find when I talk about it, even like now, I find it hard. Whereas when I was doing it en masse, August, September, October, I could just, turn it on and talk about it, and it'd all come out and it'd make a bit of sense. And very often it felt cathartic. But now I very much feel that, I've done my bit in the media, and I've talked about it enough. I've got a website where there's a huge amount of resources and media that I've done. So if there's people that want to find out more about my story, they can get to it. But my sense is I want to limit constantly going back. Some of the stuff is triggering. And a couple of days in the lead up to talking about it, and a couple of days after, a lot of these, the raw aspects of what you're talking about permeate your thoughts. And so, I've decided the thing to do is to focus on another book. And in a lot of ways, a lot of people that I've communicated with think they know me really well, and they don't know me really well. They know an aspect of my life. And I guess I've highlighted the worst, parts of my life, or the most challenging and traumatic. And, I'm going to write something that's the opposite of that, the antithesis of that. And so focusing on something different is healthy, and there's still a bit of media to do, and there's another literary festival and whatever else. But yeah, look, I don't know that it's healthy to constantly be living in the past, but my last word on this is, I've had so many responses from people where what the book has done has been incredibly helpful for them, and people that have said that I've changed their life, and they've said the most beautiful things to me. So I know it's done good. I've had so many conversations, so many uplifting conversations, that's reaffirmed doing what I've done is really important, and it's made an enormous change to many people's lives. And that's absolutely the cream on top. But yeah, look, the time is very, very close for me to put a lid on it and do something different.
You quit your job in 2018 to give yourself 1 year to investigate Father Vin and the Children of Priests. How long did you actually end up devoting to this?
I finished work August 2018, and the book came out August 2023. So it's 5 years.
Yeah.
Look, I took a year off work. I'd been in my job for, 12 and a half years. And I just wanted to take a year off because, as I say, it took 3 years to identify my father. And then I found out that he had this really colourful backstory that I wanted to investigate. And there was no intention to write a book. So I said to myself, I'll take a year off, I'll go and get another job, work out what the hell happened, and put it to bed. I've always journaled. So for as long as I can remember, I've had journals. And because of the incredibly complex nature of my life story or adoptive story, I found it really useful to sit down and put what I learn. Have learned the complexities of what I've learned in a journal, shut the document, walk away, and get it out of my head. And increasingly, my journals have sort of run to 30, 40, 50,000 words in a year. And I wanted to take this year off at the end of 2018, find out everything I could find out about my ancestry, and put it to bed. And it was only towards the end of that year that I started having communication with other children of priests and from all over the world. And the first thing you find out when you learn your father's a priest is you believe you're the only one. You're the one and only, because priests are celibate. They don't have children, and if they do, they would leave the church and marry the mother. And of course, that's not the truth. Not the truth. And the more I dug, the more I learned, the more I realized that my story was stereotypical of other people all over the world. The more I was gobsmacked to learn that there's Well, depending on who you listen to, there's an Irish organisation that talks about 20,000 children of priests globally. There's probably the most respected academic is a German woman, Dr. Doris Reisinger, who talks about well over 100,000 hidden children of priests. And some of the bare bones I was finding out that, there's 400,000 Catholic priests globally. And it is commonly accepted that only half of them are celibate. And given the reality of the church's view on contraception and abortion, there has to be a lot of children. I was digging, trying to work out why it was. If you Google children of priests, even though there's tens of millions of results, why only a handful had gone public. And I found that in 2014, the United Nations had written to the Vatican and said, you have to stop silencing the children of priests and their mothers. You have to stop issuing NDAs and confidentiality agreements to silence people. And all of a sudden it made sense. Oh, that's why you never hear from children of priests. Because if there's over 100,000, they've all been gagged by the church.
Yeah.
And the UN had given the church until 2017 to, make formal comment on these recommendations. There were, half a dozen specifically that dealt with the children of priests. And the Vatican's never replied to it. And I was looking for academic research on the children of priests, and one had begun in London. A woman by the name of Sarah Thomas, who was the child of a priest, and she'd, in her pre-conclusion of the PhD, was talking about some of the things that she'd discovered. And probably the most stunning was that 56% of the children of priests had attempted suicide or had suicidal ideation. And for one reason or another, that PhD was never concluded and her surveys were never made public. But the more people I spoke to and the more people that had similar stories to this, the more I felt this had to be made public. And there wasn't another book out there like mine that put all of these jigsaw pieces together. And that's essentially what the last third of my book is. And I felt an obligation to the children who, like me, had this astounding, shameful secret. But equally, and maybe even more so, for the mothers, because the mothers were the primary victim, in many ways, the secondary victim are the children. And the mothers, like my mother, had had a lifetime of coercion and spiritual abuse. Her scenario of a much older priest is the norm. And as well as this spiritual abuse, very often there's all sorts of other horrid scenarios that explain a pregnant woman. Very often, the stereotype is someone who's vulnerable, who's a part of the congregation. Very often they're the housekeeper or the maid, the cook within a presbytery, or very often they're people that are fleeing domestic violence and going to the priest and end up, the priest has taken advantage of these women. There's horrible outcomes. And the majority of them that I know anecdotally are those outcomes. And I just felt I had an enormous obligation to make it public, firstly for the mothers, the primary victims of this abuse, and all of the other thousands of children. And yeah, look, it stirred up a hornet's nest since the book came out. And every other day there's still contact from somebody who, has come across the book or the ABC show. I think the ABC Compass programs had 1.5 million views
Wow.
just from the YouTube airing of it. So it is having an impact.
Yeah, for sure. I'm not a journaler, but one of the most helpful things that I learned when I was doing my doctorate in creative arts was the process of creating a research journal, which is probably maybe essentially what you did. It contains insights, discoveries, references, photos, maybe documents, and more. We called it practice-led research, which is essentially like a bowerbirding process where you're collecting things that relate to that one project. I'm wondering if that was kind of part of your process, or did you have any other tools that you used to organize so much information and help you process it?
Spreadsheets.
Yeah.
I've always loved spreadsheets.
Yeah.
So yeah, look, as I was gathering data, the bowerbird process, there was all sorts of information that was coming forward, and I did make contact with the Shield family, who were all sworn to secrecy about the details they knew, and they made information available. And so, yeah, look, it was spreadsheets and journals. The journals, in a lot of ways, for me, were great around trying to nut out how I felt about a lot of things. It was, you can pour out the sort of anger and frustration, and then go back to something, days or weeks later. And be a little more logical and rational about what you've discovered and what it means, and to piece together, the struggle to sort of find a logical response to what you've discovered. And I've included, anonymously a lot of other, people that I've spoken to and their stories and how they've felt about things. It's been fascinating talking to other children of priests and working out, there's this new organization that's seemingly being formed at the moment. And it's fascinating talking to people about what you want to put to bed this issue. And, there's some common sort of themes. And, a lot of people want the church to compensate them financially. A lot of people want formal recognition by way of a letter of apology from the church, or they want their name changed, or they want their birth certificate changed. And I know adoptions, you know, a lot of this is in parallel with the needs and wants of adoptees, but you know, I think there's another layer of it if it's the church, the institution. Because as it turns out, most of the children of priests have been raised anecdotally Catholic. And so you've had a degree of indoctrination. And most people that are finding these things out are finding it out later in life. Because it's really only DNA that's discovering the truth. You know, it's really only the last 5, 6, 7 years. So in a lot of ways, it sort of feels like it's ground zero. But to talk to people and work out what they want and what I want, what I wanted more than anything was to blow the whistle and make this public and start the conversations. You know, what I wanted was to push the snowball off the top of the mountain and let others add to it. And it is getting bigger and bigger, and others, you know, taking the baton and running with it. I don't want to, you know, be the spokesperson. I don't want this to be the rest of my life. But as I say, there's so many victims in this, and the church isn't helping. And I know going public is doing good, and I absolutely needed to put it all in writing and take it to a publisher and get the attention that I did, and hopefully it'll live on, you know, for a long time, and that people can use the things I've discovered as a resource.
Yeah, you sure did blow that whistle nice and loud.
Yeah.
We're starting to run out of time, but I've got two more questions that I just have to ask. As you mentioned earlier, Father Vin was actually a very interesting guy, and you were given what I would call, for a writer, an incredible gift of resources that belonged to him or once belonged to him. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, since the Royal Commission into institutional abuse of children, the Catholic Church sent up an arm's length, supposedly secular, department called Professional Standards. And I think they're going through a rebadging exercise at the moment. Don't quote me on that, but they do often change names and locations and representatives. But the contact I had for Professional Standards, because my father was long dead, was able to give me information about my father through church records. And, you know, she's a wonderful person who no longer works for the church. Surprise, surprise. Made information available. And in our ongoing discussions, I said, can I see the letter? I just want to see his handwriting. You know, you've got photos? Can I see photos? You know, where? And it turned out the church had hundreds, 300 letters that he'd written, all back and forth from the church to him and whatnot. And he'd done a lot of international travel and whatnot. And with her support, not through the support of the church, but through her support, and she's not Catholic, convinced the church that they should make the information available to me. And they did. And that's a rarity. So I'm grateful to the local bishop that stuck his neck out and made that available to me. And it was a treasure trove of information that allowed me to trace specific times in his life, where he was, and to also piece together the connection he had to my birth mother, but as I say, did extend to decades. So, have I answered the question? I think I've
you gone. Have, you have, yeah. And because that was one of the things I found so interesting and surprising, actually, about your memoir. Because with creative nonfiction and memoir, you have a little bit of rope, I guess, with which to write. It's not just pure biographical writing. You can be a bit creative in how you tell a story. And some of the chapters are written in the memoir from Father Vin's point of view in an omniscient third person voice. How did you arrive at that decision to include those chapters written the way they were?
Well, I was doing a lot of reading I was trying to find books that were written around the era he was there. So his diocese was from Broken Hill to Port Augusta. So apparently it's, for the era, it was the second largest diocese in the world. And he had a combi. It's a fairly, well, it's an amazing landscape out there. It's the most desolate landscape I've ever seen. And essentially he just, slowly chugged along and dealt with parishioners and stations and mining towns and people that were working on the railways for decades. And I did reading that spoke about that part of the world and from that era, and it was very evocative. And I didn't, yeah, look at I got a lot of help early on. So I worked with Sian Pryor, who is a great writer and written a couple of memoirs. And, I think it was her suggestion as an exercise to write some chapters in his eyes because these letters were so evocative of where he was and the temperature and the desert and combi vans breaking down in the middle of nowhere, and some of them stuck. I wrote a lot of them, and I think in the book there's four or five of key moments in his life of what I imagined occurred. Look, it was a good device. So the last thing I wanted to do was, chronological from day dot to, current. And so to have a non-chronological order made sense. But people have liked the chapters in his eyes that go back to the sort of 50s and 60s. And he did most of his study in a Trappist monastery in Ireland and spent time in New York City. And it was too tempting having those letters and those places and eras not to make use of them for the book, which I think breaks it up a bit.
Last question, Brendan. Memoir literally means written to be remembered. What do you hope is the remembered legacy of Tell No One?
Well, not my story. That's not about my story. My story is used as a vehicle to put what's happened to the mothers and the children of priests in the public eye. And maybe it sounds like it's, well, it is egotistical to say there isn't another book like mine. There's very few books by children of priests, less than a handful, memoirs, factual. I hope the things I found out can get to the largest possible audience and that other people can build on it. And it's not about my story. It's about finding out that my story isn't exceptional. It's incredibly ordinary. And the church has conducted itself in the most shameful way. And there's tens of thousands, maybe there's hundreds of thousands of people that have similar experiences to me that have suffered, and the church hasn't helped. And I want that to be public.
Brendan Watkins, thank you so much for joining us today, sharing your experience and some of your writing process with us. I know it's going to help a lot of people.
Good on you. Thanks, Joe.
And I'll be putting up links to purchase Brendan's book, Tell No One, and also to his website on our podcast notes page. And meanwhile, if you have a story that you'd like to share with us and you'd like to be interviewed for the podcast, just jump onto the podcast page of the Jigsaw Queensland website and complete the prospective guest form that you'll find there. And just note that Adopt Perspective can be and is listened to by people all over the world. Bye for now. Thanks for listening to the Adopt Perspective podcast. If you'd like to find out more, go to the podcast page on www.jigsawqueensland.com and you'll find a wealth of information and resources on the website. If you reside in Queensland, you can reach Jigsaw Queensland's Forced Adoption Support Service on toll-free 1800 210313, or you can call Jigsaw on 07
03 58 66 66. If you live in another state of Australia, you can still call the Forced Adoption Support Service number, and your call will be answered by the Forced Adoption Support Service in the state that you're calling from. In every other state, Relationships Australia operates this service. A big thank you to Matt Sparrow for composing and recording our original theme music. Until next time, I'm Jo Sparrow, saying farewell from Adopt Perspective, a podcast for anyone affected by adoption. Thank you.